I'm going to try to give a talk that's off-topic, but hopefully not so off-topic that nobody will care about what's going to happen. So I'm going to try to report on attempts at producing mirrors to manifolds without the help of physicists, which I view somehow as the next natural step in mirror symmetry for mathematicians, because, you know, there are all these conjectures that physicists have told us about, and, well, there are these examples of mirror pairs that physicists have told us about. And, you know, what are we going to do if we don't have friendly physicists around to tell us, look, you should prove that this guy and this guy are mirror to each other? So, well, it's probably, you know, a good idea for mathematicians to try to understand how to come up with such examples. So I'm going to try to take an approach based on the Strominger-Yau-Zaslow conjecture for producing mirror pairs. And I won't tell you too much today about why I expect these guys to be mirrors. I'm rather going to try to produce things. And, well, you have to trust me that some of the predictions of mirror symmetry at least seem to hold for these guys. So I should say, if you want to read more about this, there's a paper on the archive. And there's another, the second half of the talk will be stuff, work in progress, with Mohamed Abu Zaid and Ludmil Kedzarkov. That one is not written yet. So let me remind you, the usual setting for mirror symmetry would be Calabi-Yau manifolds. And so you would have, so for me, a Calabi-Yau is what some of you might call a weak Calabi-Yau, in the sense that it's just a Kähler manifold whose canonical bundle is holomorphically trivial, and hence I can equip it with a holomorphic volume form, globally defined. However, I do not require the norm of the holomorphic volume form to be constant with respect to the Kähler metric. Not some of the time. For now, it's compact, but I'm going to do non-compact ones soon. So it's kind of compact. And so mirror symmetry tells us that, well, we should be able to find, at least in good cases, a mirror Calabi-Yau in such a way that somehow the Kähler form on the mirror depends only on the complex data on X and vice versa. And, well, there's various predictions, such as the Gromov-Witten invariance of one can be computed via the B model on the other one, and equivalences between derived categories of coherent sheaves and Fourier categories, or things like that. So I'm not going to spend too much time on the details. So now the question is, how do we, you know, what I'm going to focus on is how do we find examples of such things? So this originates in the Strominger-Yau-Zaslow conjecture, which, roughly speaking, says that X and its mirror carry mutually dual vibrations by special Lagrangian tori. Well, there's a lot of fine print that goes with that, such as how you actually need to work hard to get examples of such vibrations, and even then you might need to modify things because these vibrations are singular, and then you cannot quite dualize near the singular fibers. Instead, you have to include corrections that come from instantons and do various kinds of things. So, you know, there's more fine print than in an insurance contract. So I should mention that, you know, there's been lots of work by Joyce, Fouquier, Concevich, Seubelmann, and Gross and Siebert, with quite a lot of breakthroughs by Gross and Siebert recently in trying to make this more precise and come up with concrete, explicit, rigorous constructions. So now, just to give you some quick intuition for why this might make sense in case you... Well, I'm sure that physicists have very good explanations for that, but for a mathematician, where might this come from? So the observation you can make is, well, you know, let's say that we believe in homological mirror symmetry above everything else. I'm not sure if that's a reasonable position to take, but let's say that we take Concevich's conjectures for granted and we want to get this. Well, let's think for a moment about what kinds of things we can do. So here's the most fundamental example of moduli spaces in all of mathematics. If you've never seen a moduli space, here's a good example. Well, a moduli space of points in X-check is X-check. Okay, it's moduli space of its own points. I guess physicists would say D0 brains or something like that. So now the question is, well, now that we've said this guy X-check is the moduli space of points in X-check, can we use mirror symmetry to view it as a moduli space of something in X? Well, yes, we should. So the question is, if we have a point in X check, let's say P, what are we going to do to it? Well, so I can look at the skyscraper sheaf at the point P as an object of the derived category of coherent sheaves. Well, don't even need to derive here. So it should correspond to some object, let's get the answer P, in the derived Fourier category of X. And what kind of object should it be? So, well, I'm not going to say too much about Fourier categories, but objects in there are essentially Lagrangian submanifolds together with flat unitary vector bundles over them. So to figure out what it is, I should look at the endomorphisms of this object of a derived category. So X of OP with itself. And any good algebraic geometer will tell you that this looks, at least as a vector space, this is the same thing as the cohomology of the torus TM. So that's an indication that this should correspond to a Lagrangian torus in X together with a flat line bundle over it. I mean, of course, it could be also some weird object of a derived category instead of being an honest, nice Lagrangian, but the simpler assumption would be one. So the concrete proposal that's hiding behind this is that we should think of X check possibly as a moduli space of pairs consisting of a special Lagrangian. Sorry, I have to. In general, maybe it's just a Lagrangian torus, but we know that in the Fourier category, Hamiltonian isotopic Lagrangians are meant to be the same thing. So we need to actually pick one in each isotopic class. And, well, you know, assuming stability properties, you expect that you would have one that's special Lagrangian. So if you want to somehow put more geometry into the picture, special helps. I don't have a much better explanation of why, except that, well, various things work well in the situation. And the other thing we need to have is a flat unitary connection on, let's say, just the trivial complex line bundle over L. Okay, so that's going to be the ansatz for, well, the first guess for the mirror. And it doesn't quite work because of various things. But that's basically what the intuition says. So, okay, let me extend the scope of what I'm going to do by actually not restricting myself to Calabi-Yau's. So for that, I have to introduce Landau Innsbruck models. So the slogan, well, let's say that I have a Kaelor manifold, but I'm not assuming it to be Calabi-Yau, so possibly its first chunk class might not be zero. But let me make an assumption, which is that I have inside X an anti-canonical divisor. So a hypersurface, possibly with sufficiently mild singularities, such that, well, the class of D is the first chunk class of X. So then automatically the complement of D is an open Calabi-Yau manifold. One way to see that, well, so if D is anticanonical, means that D is the zero set of some section of the anticanonical bundle, which is the bundle of zero n forms, if you want. And then if I take the inverse of sigma, that's going to be a holomorphic volume form with poles along D. So I have all the structures I need on X minus D, and if I'm lucky, well, it turns out, at least in examples, that I can try to look for, I can try to apply this SYZ principle, even though this is non-compact, things still work fine. There's a there seem to be families of compact special Lagrangian tori on these things. So I might be able to build an open Calabi-Yau mirror to X minus D, for example, via SYZ. The question is, now, how do I put D back in here? And so the answer to that comes from thinking a little bit harder about what kinds of features the A model on X has. And essentially, it has all the unpleasant features that you might not want to see. So, for example, you know, if I have a Lagrangian submanifold in X minus D, then sure, it has Fleur homology in X minus D, which typically tends to be well defined and interesting. Maybe in, you know, typical cases, it might look like the usual cohomology of L. However, if you try to define Fleur homology in X for L, then you'll be somehow confronted to the fact that your Lagrangian L tends to bound a lot of holomorphic disks in X that hit D. And these disks somehow obstruct Fleur theory for L in X. So, and I probably shouldn't get into technicality, but, well, first of all, this Fleur homology often tends to be zero, which means that L is actually usually a zero object in the Fourier category of X. And second, well, we even have trouble with the Fleur homology, sorry, with the Fourier category, because we have trouble defining morphisms between L and L prime. Fleur homology of L and L prime for two different Lagrangians typically is not well defined. Because of obstructions coming from precisely, again, these disks. So in fact, this obstruction is encoded by something called M0, which is a Fleur theoretic gadget that counts holomorphic disks with boundary on L and will somehow modify Fleur theory significantly to the extent that we can't make sense of it anymore in the usual way.
You mean that we need to sort of out the X or on X?
On X. Okay. I mean, there might be problems on X minus D, but even, I mean, in typical examples, X minus D is very well behaved and X is a mess. And so this count of holomorphic disks somehow this holomorphic discrete boundary on L prevents the definition of Fleur homology. I mean, if you look at Fukaya, Ota, and Ono's papers on anomalies in Fleur homology, that's perhaps the most comprehensive treatment of these kinds of problems. So what that means, if we look at this slogan up there, well, either our mirror is going to somehow be very, very small, have very few points, and somehow very little geometry to it, which is not a very pleasant prospect, or we must come up with some way to somehow obstruct the theory, obstruct the B model, so that first feature, most points become trivial, become the zero object in the derived category. And second, well, actually, even the very notion of complex is deformed somehow. And that's what a superpotential will do. So the solution to that is to look for a mirror that's what's called a Landau-Ginzburg model. And for me, that just means a Kähler manifold. And a function, a holomorphic complex valued function. So, and then in this language, we're going to have to modify all of the statements of mirror symmetry. So, for example, just to show you how we lift the difficulty I've raised, you replace the derived category of coherent sheaves with somebody else. So instead of a derived category of coherent sheaves on M, you will look at something that's sometimes called DB sing, or sometimes called matrix factorizations of W. So just to give you a quick preview of what I hope maybe somebody else will do more in detail at some point. So these are, well, so I should say, okay, I should put various names, I should put, wait, Anton, did you do stuff about that? Yes, okay. Justin, Bondal, I'm not sure about Bondal. Well, many other people. Sorry, I should have worked on my bibliography. So anyway, there's two different ways to define this guy. One of them is essentially you look at the level sets of this function W. And you look only at each fiber. On each fiber of W, you take the derived category of coherent sheaves, and you quotient it out by perfect complexes, which means everything that comes that's essentially looks like vector bundles, complexes of vector bundles. So that's something that measures purely the singularities of W. So, and in particular, if I fix a point P in M, so the claim is that there's a non-trivial object supported at a point P if and only if P is a critical point of a superpotential. So most points become trivial just by virtue of having added this function W. And that somehow should resonate with, you know, the feature that Fleur homology tends to be trivial for Lagrangians. Somehow we are left only with critical points. And the other incarnation of this category as matrix factorization. So a matrix factorization essentially is a pair of modules over whatever ring of functions you might have, together with maps P and Q, with a property that P times Q equals superpotential minus constant times identity of one, and QP similarly. So just to simplify things, you know, you can think of just a pair of matrices with entries, functions on this guy, such that when you multiply them both ways, you get a multiple of, W times identity. And that somehow should remind you of the fact that we're deforming the notion of complex so that the square of a differential is M0 instead of 0. Okay. So I think that's all I'm going to try to do in terms of motivation. So the slogan, again, is going to be now to look for the mirror of something that's not Calabi-Yau. We'll try to build a Calabi-Yau manifold, which will be the mirror to this open stratum x minus d. And then we'll try to equip that with a holomorphic function that will somehow count disks bounded by Lagrangians when you allow them to pass through d. Definitely. Is the mirror to the closed guy X. Exactly. Yes. So this one, the conjecture, the homological mirror symmetry conjecture here says that this should be equivalent to the Fourier category of X. Yeah, essentially because you can, Well, so essentially it's just the fact that the Fleur homology for a Lagrangian is going to be zero. I mean, I'm going to give you the example of CP2 where you will see a little bit better. The skyscraper sheaves, you mean? No, because the guys that you resolve with are, I mean, so basically everybody here, well, I wouldn't know how to see it, actually. And one issue with that is essentially, you know, the guys by which you resolve, oh, actually, you probably can. But see, they're only sheaves over the open stratum. Because when you look at them as this guy, you know, as, I mean, coherent sheaves on M, as opposed to objects of this weird category, that means they're only mirror to Lagrangians in X. And in particular, you know, you'll need to probably resolve by non-compactly supported things. So non-compactly supported things will have to correspond to things with which do not extend well to the compactification. That's correct. That's correct. Yeah, that's it's a slightly surprising feature. Maybe one way to justify, actually. So maybe I should give a bit of motivation for why I need this guy D as well. So unfortunately, for that, I have to go now to the A model of the Landau-Ginzburg model. So if I have a Landau-Ginzburg model, there's also a notion of what kinds of Lagrangians I want to look at to define the Fourier category of this thing. And so, I mean, I think this goes back to Hori, Iqbal, and Vafa, possibly others before. I should say I'm completely ignorant of most of the physics literature, so apologies in advance if I'm forgetting your fundamental contribution to something. Okay, so anyway, so we want to look at Lagrangian submanifolds in M that might be non-compact, but if they are non-compact, then they must go to infinity in a very specific way. Namely, you want the superpotential on them to map, well, outside of a compact subset at least, they should just map to basically a half line that goes straight to infinity. Okay. Now, so the interesting feature of this category is it comes equipped with extra data. And the reason is basically that you can bend these lines. You know, you can, instead of going to infinity to the right, you could go along with another slope. And there's a natural operation you can do which replaces each Lagrangian with the guy that basically I mean, it's a twist operation near infinity. It's defined in terms of a Hamiltonian diffeomorphism of M, which is given by a Hamiltonian, which is basically norm squared of W, something like that. And so that defines for you. So the claim is out of this. I'm not going to want to give any details. But the claim is the Fourier category of a Landau-Ginzburg model comes equipped with, well, it has a non-trivial Serre functor. Which on objects is given exactly by this kind of operation. And moreover, it comes with a canonical natural transformation. From the Serre functor to identity, or S inverse. I'm not sure. Might be the other way around. So anyway, there's a bunch of extra data, which I don't want to go into category theory, but so if you go back to mirror side, where it is meant to be the same thing as the derived category of coherent sheaves on X, the Serre functor is just tensoring by the canonical bundle. Inverse. No, canonical. Yes, and shifting by N. So I want to put a shift up to signs, something. And so anyway, the claim is this data should give me naturally a section of K inverse. It's encoded in the data that comes with the A model, with the A brains on Landau-Ginzburg model. And so that means that I do need to have an anticanonical divisor, and the dependence on D, if I move D around, I will see the dependence in a subtle way on the Fourier category of this guy. But I wouldn't see it anywhere else. So somehow the same X has lots of different mirrors, well, assuming that there is freedom to move D around. And it doesn't really matter for most practical purposes. But it also means that as far as I know, usually one says the condition that we need here is that X should be Fano. I don't see that as necessarily needed. However, what I'm sure is needed is some property that the anticanonical class should be effective. Otherwise, we'll have to somehow play around and somehow make up new rules. But these kinds of constructions require the anticanonical to be effective. Okay. I should probably move on because so another thing I need to tell you about is a bit more about this construction of a mirror using special Lagrangians and why what I get. I'm going to at least motivate why I always get a complex manifold. So the direction I'm going to focus on really is thinking of X and the divisor D in it. And I'm going to look at symplectic geometry here and use that to build the mirror M and the superpotential W as a complex manifold with a holomorphic function on it. Okay. So I want to remind you that if I have L in, well, I guess in X minus T, I'm going to say that it's special Lagrangian. If it's Lagrangian and moreover, when I restrict the holomorphic volume form to L, I will get a non-zero multiple of a volume form on L, and I want that multiple to be actually real, so no imaginary part. And so now it's a well-known result that deformations of special Lagrangians correspond naturally to the first cohomology of L with real coefficients. And so in fact, one way to see this correspondence, so if I have a submanifold L and I want to deform it a bit, to deform a submanifold, I need to use some normal vector field and flow it along this normal vector field, and I can build a one form out of that just by plugging that vector field into the Kähler form. So that will give me a one form on L. And the condition that the deformation be Lagrangian is that alpha should be closed. The condition that the deformation should be special Lagrangian usually is that alpha should be harmonic. That would be in the Calabi-Yau case. Here in the setting where we have where the norm of the holomorphic volume form is not constant, it's actually slightly different. It's d star of some scaling factor times alpha, where this is basically the norm of omega. But anyway, so there's a correspondence with cohomologies. And so now, if you are still skeptical about why I need to put a flat connection on my Lagrangian, that's because I want to complexify this set of deformations. So if I look at the set of pairs consisting of a special Lagrangian torus and a flat U1 connection on trivial bundle up to gauge, so really just a unitary local system, well, the tangent space at a given point, I can probably understand in terms of, well, I need to be able to deform my special Lagrangian, so a normal vector field, and I need to deform the connection by adding an imaginary connection one form, where, well, so if I plug V into omega, I should get a closed, actually, harmonic or modified harmonic one form, and also the connection form should also be closed because I want my connection to be flat. And, well, exact forms don't matter to me because I'm only looking at the holonomy. So I can just require these to be a complex-valued harmonic form on L. Okay, so this gives me naturally an almost complex structure on N, because each tangent space is now canonically a complex vector space. So the interesting thing is actually this is an integrable complex structure. And if I want to see holomorphic coordinates on it, one way to get a holomorphic function is this. So let's say that I fix a relative homotopic class for a disk in X with boundary on L. Then I can compute the following thing. I can take the exponential of minus the symplectic area of this disk. So that's going to be a positive real number. And then I can multiply that by the holonomy of the connection along the boundary of my disk. That's a unit complex number. So let's call that Z sub beta. This is going to be locally a complex valued function on M. Only locally because I don't know in advance that when I move L, I can follow this class beta everywhere. And so the claim is this is going to be a holomorphic function. So if you have enough such disks, this gives you a set of holomorphic coordinates. So okay, so let's do an example quickly. So let's look at the case of toric manifolds. So here there's previous works of Horry, Cho and O, and others. So let me take the example of CP2, and if you read between the lines, you will see that it works exactly the same way for any toric manifold. Okay? So what's a toric manifold? It's something that contains a big open stratum, which is C star to the N, complex torus, and the complement. So basically, you can think of it holomorphically, it's just a way to compactify C star to the N. And so the toric divisor is actually, in the case of CP2, it's the union of the free coordinate lines. In general, so you know, a toric manifold is something that has an action of Tn and a compatible Kähler structure. And the orbit space for the Tn action is always a polytope. So you have this moment polytope, which is the orbit space for the toric action. So above each point in the interior, you have a torus, which in C star to the N is just a product of circles. And then when you get to the edges, you collapse some of the factors. So in my picture, the open stratum is the interior of a moment polytope, and the divisor is the entire boundary. So this carries, well, I can put a toric Kähler form, for example, the standard Fubini-Study form. And I can always put the standard holomorphic volume form, dz1, dzn, well, I guess here there's only two, divided by z1 to zn. That's the standard holomorphic volume form of C star to the n. It has poles along d, and that's the setting I was in. So now, I guess I should put an I to, well, in general, there would be an I to the n for normalization. So now you can easily check that the Tn orbits are special Lagrangian. And somehow this is the mother of all the examples of special Lagrangian fibrations that have been built. So now you can ask yourself, well, what does that give me when I look at this mirror thing? And the easiest way to think about it is that you have holomorphic, it's a space which has holomorphic coordinates given by these z betas. So actually, maybe I should just tell you in the case of CP2, I can use just two coordinates. So if I think of, so my torus, it's just a product of two circles, and it certainly bounds various kinds of disks. So for example, it bounds a disk of radius r1 in the first coordinate axis. Or it bounds a disk of radius r2 in the second coordinate axis. And let's call beta 1 the class of this thing. Let's call beta 2 the class of that thing. And now I have coordinates z beta 1 and z beta 2, which are coordinates on the mirror, which actually is going to end up being a subset of C star squared. I'm not going to insist too much on the subset thing because, well, Horry and Vaffa at least claim that renormalization, which essentially amounts to some flow to a larger volume here, will make the mirror eventually be all of C star squared. So anyway, the mirror I get in this way, well, the C star squared that I get is essentially the Calabi-Yau mirror to the open Calabi-Yau C star squared that I had here for the open stratum. So far, nothing's very surprising. The reason why I get a subset only, if you want, is that in here, I had a Kähler form that was incomplete because it extended across the compactification divisors. So the incompleteness of a Kähler form, the fact that I had finite Kähler volume here, means that I will get actually a bounded subset of C star squared. That's a slightly weird feature here. Okay, so now let's try to put on the superpotential. I forgot to give you the general definition. So the way I want to define the superpotential is as a count of special of holomorphic disks. So given a point of a mirror, that's a Lagrangian and a connection on it, I will want to look at all homotopy classes in which I might have a holomorphic disk, but only those with Maslow index 2. So to avoid defining Maslow index, that will just mean the Maslow index is twice the intersection number with a divisor D. Okay, so that means disks in classes that hit once the divisor D. And then I will count n beta should be the number of holomorphic disks in class beta through a given point of L. So I want to count, fix a point P on L, and I want to count holomorphic disks with boundary on L representing the class beta whose boundary passes through this point P. And so in general, I would expect the number of such disks to be finite if everything behaves well. And of course, in general, things don't behave well. So there's a big warning sign that this number is normally not well defined. And in particular, even if I can find a way to define number using various technology, well, the number might not be unique. So this function here, in general, might be slightly ill-defined. Now, in the toric case, I don't have to worry, because in the case of a toric manifold, in fact, there is a unique holomorphic disk in each of the possible classes. So what do I mean by possible classes? So I said I want to look at disks which hit the divisor D once. In my case, the divisor D is the union of all the toric strata. So I must hit exactly one of the strata and not the others. And now the claim is for each stratum, there's a unique family of disks which hits it. So for example, if I want to hit the second coordinate axis, well, the only solution is the obvious disk that I wrote here. For the second one, the same thing here. And then there's, of course, a third one, because actually in CP2, I have three different, and I have three homogeneous coordinates. So that one, I leave to your imagination. It represents the third class, beta 3. And you can easily check that the numbers for each of these are 1. So what does that tell me? So that tells me that the superpotential I should put on my M should be the sum of the contributions from these three families of disks, z beta 1, z beta 2, z beta 3. But we have a relation between them. So, have I erased yet? No, I haven't erased yet. Very good. That's the most important thing here. So if you look at this formula, you'll see that it's multiplicative. So if I, you know, if I take a disk whose class is the sum of two other classes, then these variables are just the product. So the observation is that the sum of the classes of the disks that I have up there is actually equal to the class of CP1, just the sphere inside CP2, the line inside CP2. So what that means is that these variables are related by, so their product is the weight I would associate to CP1, which is e to the minus its area, and then, well, there's no boundary. CP1 is a closed So manifold, so actually it's just exponential of minus the area of CP1. Okay, and that is, well, at least to some of you, I hope, a familiar formula for the mirror of CP2. Okay, and the same thing works for all toric varieties. So now, you can play with examples and build in this way mirrors of several interesting things. I thought I would try to give you a small teaser preview for stuff in progress that's not quite written up yet. So the claim is that we can get the following examples by this kind of construction. So let's say that we have X, a toric variety. Nothing very surprising so far. And now in there, let's take H, take just one component of a toric divisor. And inside H, I will take Y, which is a hypersurface in H, smooth. So in fact, it's codimension 2 inside X. Here I'm still taking D, the toric anticanonical divisor. From this data, I can construct the blow up of X along Y. Y has codimension 2 inside X. And so I need to equip it with some data. So I need to choose suitably a Kähler form. There's a choice of parameter, which is the size that I will give to the exceptional divisor, so the blow up. And I need to equip it with a holomorphic volume form outside of some anticanonical divisor. Well, that's where I use the fact that the guy I blew up, Y, was contained inside one of the toric strata. Because that allows me to just define omega hat to be the pullback of the toric holomorphic volume form under the blow-up map. And this has poles along d hat, which is the proper transform of d. So the program, and I should say, it's still in progress. I'd like to say it's almost complete. It's only missing some little bit of analysis. So actually, if you're willing to admit Lagrangian vibrations instead of special Lagrangian vibrations, then everything is completely proved. Otherwise, there's still a tiny bit of work remaining to be done. So we can build a special Lagrangian vibration on x hat minus d hat, then we can build m and w, and then we can look at how the function w in this case is actually discontinuous, and we can start crying about how somehow things are not fair because these numbers n beta jump. So the slogan is that n beta jump, there's wall crossing phenomena, which is due to the fact that sometimes, accidentally, your Lagrangian will end up bounding a disk of Maslow index 0. And when you pass through such a wall, the numbers of disks of Maslow index 2 change because disks of Maslow index 0 attach themselves to disks, and that changes how many you have. So you can analyze wall crossing. And what you can do is you can actually find a way to compute the instanton corrections needed and you can get a new mirror with a new superpotential out of somehow modifying this guy a little bit, and now this is actually an honest holomorphic function Well, this one was discontinuous. Piecewise holomorphic. So instead of trying to trying to do the general case in 8 minutes, let me just do the case of blowing up C2 at a point, but not correctly. Okay. So you can try to argue a little bit by, the blow up of C2 at a point certainly is a toric manifold, but I don't want to think of it as a toric manifold. So I'm going to blow up a point that's not the origin. Okay. And it really illustrates the general case. The general case is the same thing, just product with, somehow in families along the way. But before I do that, maybe I should tell you why I care. So why do we care? Well, the answer to that is essentially there's a bunch of results, but the most interesting one is a theorem that says of Gondal and Olof, which says the derived category of coherent sheaves on the blow-up has a decomposition, a semi-orthogonal decomposition into those of X and Y. And so in particular, if X was particularly boring, after all, toric varieties are never all that complicated, then this guy essentially picks up what we had in Y. There's expectedly similar results about Fourier categories. So what I want to argue is that this guy is the next best thing to Y itself. So if we find a mirror to the blow-up, that's almost as good as having a mirror to Y. So we can think of the mirror of X blow-up on Y as a substitute for the mirror of Y. And in fact, in concrete examples, you can even isolate somehow a subset of this Landau-Ginzburg model, which will be the contribution of Y as opposed to that of X. So just to give you an example of what the final product looks like, the mirror of a pair of pants, so if you want CP1 minus 3 points, ends up being the Landau-Ginzburg model XYZ on C cubed. And there's work of Abu Zaid and Seidel showing indeed relations between Fourier, part of homological mirror symmetry for these. Another example before I go back to the one I can try to show you something concrete about. If I take a genus 2 curve, C, and embed it inside CP1 times CP1, say something of by degree, the zero set of a polynomial of by degree 2, 3, and embed that inside P1 cubed. So that's the setup for that's X, and that's like equal Y. Then I will get a threefold with some superpotential. And the critical locus of this superpotential consists of a union of three CP1s intersecting at 2 points. And in fact, the fiber of the superpotential through this thing is a union of three surfaces, two of them compact, one non-compact, doesn't really matter. And they pairwise intersect along these rational curves, and there's triple intersections at those 2 points. And there's partial calculations showing indeed that homological mirror symmetry seems to hold at least partially for these things. So somehow that's a way to build a mirror for something that shouldn't have one. Okay, so having already spent half of my remaining few minutes, not sure what I will say about blowing up a point, but let me try very briefly. Okay, so the toy example that's at the root of all this is, so let's say that I take C2 and I take the standard holomorphic volume form, the standard scalar form, and I blow it up at the point 1, 0. So actually, let me make an even more toy example. C star times C, it's less compact and it's easier to deal with. Okay, so the divisor D in that is C star times 0, that's where this has poles, and I'm blowing up a point contained in D, that's legal. And so I have a new guy hat. D hat will be the proper transform, and omega hat will be from the standard form on the blow up, giving area epsilon to the exceptional P1. So the observation is, if I set things up this way, and actually in the general case as well, I have an S1 action on this blow up. Okay, so here I had, of course, a torus action, but I've broken part of the symmetry by blowing up a point that's not toric. I still have the other S1 action. So S1 acts by rotation on the y variable. And the action lifts to the blow up. However, on the blow up, there's a new fixed point. So the fixed points there's one stratum of fixed points, which is the proper transform of the fixed points of the action downstairs, and there's a new isolated fixed point on the exceptional divisor. It's essentially the point where the other coordinate axis through 1, 0 hits the exceptional divisor. And, oh, sorry. So now, in this example, you can build explicitly a special Lagrangian fibration, because, so let's denote by mu the moment map for the S1 action that I told you about. Then I want to define L T1, T2 to be the set of points where log norm x equals T1 and mu equals T2. So maybe I should mention, so before the blow up, mu was norm squared of y up to a scaling constant. So essentially this is replacing, I used to fix the norm of x and the norm of y, and now I'm replacing y with fixing the value of the moment map. So that's, the claim is this is special Lagrangian. And if I try to look at the base of this fibration, well, it still looks like a half plane like before, except now there's a singularity. And in fact, if I try to put a suitable affine structure on that, I'll see that things somehow break down. So that would be T2, that would be T1. And here I have some evil monodrome. So the reason for the accident is that L0 epsilon is singular. One way to think about it is this is a union of S1 orbits. However, one of the S1 orbits is collapsed to a point when I pass through that point, P0, the new fixed point. So there's one singularity, and the monodromy of the fibration. So if I think of this family of special Lagrangians as a fibration on my blow up, then there's a monodromy around here, which is like 1, 1, 1, 0, the usual kind. So now if I try to think about, let me change my mind again about C star versus C. So actually I was blowing up C squared and then. So now if I look at my favorite special Lagrangian, so one of these guys in this vibration, it bounds again two types of holomorphic disks, namely those which hit, well, proper transforms of disks parallel to the second coordinate axis and proper transforms of disks parallel to the first coordinate axis, roughly. So the superpotential should be the sum of two variables that are, well, let's call this class, I don't know. But I mean, let's just write W equals Z1 plus Z2 here, where Z1 and Z2 are the weights of these two guys. And now, on the other hand, if I go over here, well, if I look at a Lagrangian torus here, it bounds, you will find that surprisingly, it bounds three different families of disks. So there's still one here, there's still one here, but there's another one that essentially looks like that. If I'm drawing a tropical picture, it's somehow, I mean, in fact, it's the thickening of that. So here I would get a different formula. For the superpotential. So the point is, actually, I need to modify my formula for the mirror. Oh, crap. I have a problem with my notations. OK, I can probably try to do it anyway. So here, the formula I will get is Z1 plus Z2 plus the third guy corresponds to Z1, Z2, e to the epsilon. So that's certainly discontinuous. And the way that you somehow patch for the discontinuity is by modifying the gluing between these two things. So let me put a twiddle here for. I'm going to have two different coordinate charts. Here I have a coordinate chart with coordinates Z1, Z2. Here I have a coordinate chart with, no, sorry, Z1 twiddle Z2. And the usual gluing would have been Z1 equals Z1 twiddle. But that doesn't work. What actually works is to glue these two together in such a way that Z1 corresponds to Z1 twiddle times 1 plus Z2 e to the epsilon. And so, in fact, well, I'm lying to you about various things. But at the end of the day, what you get, I claim, is the set points, forgot the key thing, uv z2 in c squared times c star, such that uv is 1 plus e to the epsilon z2, where you should think of v is z1 inverse and u is z1. Yes. OK, so sorry, I'm being very incoherent because I'm over time. But the claim is you can build explicitly the instanton corrected mirror for this situation, and now the superpotential will be defined just by u plus z2 on this. And you can check out that it's a perfectly fine holomorphic function. However, it has picked up a singularity at this point. So, you know, it looks like it was just the sum of two coordinate axes. However, the fact that we modified our mirror to incorporate the singularity into it means that actually this function z2 now has a critical point at basically u equals v equals 0. So that's, you know, a way in which somehow the blow-up has modified things in a way that looks completely innocent but has created a new singularity in the superpotential. So now if you do that on more fancy examples, blowing up something of higher dimension along a curve or whatever you want of codimension 2, then typically you will create strata of singularities corresponding to the instanton corrected version of the new fixed points of the S1 action in the proper in the exceptional divisor of the blow-up. And so that gives you these kinds of examples. OK, I should really stop here because I'm vastly over time. Thank you.